This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. News, emotion, moving forward in the Middle East. Is that possible? Moving forward in the World Cup final outcome, certainly possible for the Germans and their fans, harder for the people of South America today. We will be also exploring the very murky legal world of environmental crime and why is it so difficult to get federal prosecutions started, let alone those prosecutions to actually stick. But we begin in the Middle East. Sound of rockets being fired into Israel from Gaza, answering Israeli airstrikes, continuing unabated since last week. Reports this morning that a drone fired from Gaza was shot down. Israeli sources there. A possible alarming new development if Hamas, the leadership in Gaza, has such a capability. Israel says Hamas has no interest in anything but escalating this conflict.
We need to defeat those people, roll them back, or peace is not going to be possible. Because as far as Hamas is concerned, they couldn't care less if you come with a two-state solution, a three-state solution, or a four-state solution. They want a no-state solution, no Jewish state.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking there on the CBS News Face the Nation program, where there was also a statement from Ma'in Rashid Arakat, the Palestinian envoy in Washington.
Our objective right now is to reach an immediate ceasefire, return to the 2012 understandings between Hamas and Israel. You have to also to remember, so far Israel have carried out 1,300 airstrikes against the Gaza Strip.
But is that the objective of anyone right now? And what of the senior officials who last month were trying to move forward towards a settlement as tensions rise in Syria and Iraq?
I don't think there's a problem on the Israeli side. They will agree to a ceasefire. The problem is, how do you get Hamas to agree to a ceasefire? They're looking for something that they can claim as a victory.
That's former U.S. Special Mideast Envoy Martin Indyk speaking on the NBC News program Meet the Press, speaking of his frustration and very much out of the loop these days as the forces of Israel and Gaza pound away at each other. For an update, we welcome Ethan Bronner, former Jerusalem bureau chief and currently deputy national editor for our partner, The New York Times. Ethan, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John.
So this seems to be a very tense situation. Just the idea that the tensions on one side of Gaza and on the other side of Gaza are going to be contained. How long can any of this be sustained, in your view?
Well, as you know, having spent many years there and watching the place, predicting what happens in the Middle East is a fool's game. We have only the past to go on in our sense of where things stand. And part of the problem is that, you know, a year and a half ago, this occurred, and a week later, there was a ceasefire. But the government in Egypt is different. And the other thing I think to remember is that every time these exercises occur or these hostilities occur and they don't end things, then in many ways, oddly, sentiments harden on both sides. And I think that right now, in an odd way, both Israel and Hamas feel that there is something to be gained by continuing it a bit longer.
You know, you make a really important point. Egypt is on the sidelines here for political reasons that, you know, we don't need to go into at this point. And for very different reasons, the U.S. seems in relative terms to be on the sidelines here in this particular situation. And that is sort of driving this forward, wouldn't you say?
I would say. I mean, I think the fact that the U.S.-led effort between Israel and the Palestinian Authority failed just recently has kind of, you know, taken the wind from any American diplomatic sails in this point. And as you say, the Egyptians, of course, have a different government. They're not allies of Hamas anymore. And I think that, you know, the Israeli view is we can't put up with a force like Hamas having these rockets in their arsenal anymore. And Hamas, which had been sidelined as a result of what happened in Egypt and as a result of the what was going on between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, I think is finding some value in having the world focus again on Gaza and on its resistance capacity. And, you know, as I say, I think that both sides feel, as long as it doesn't go out of control, that there is value here. And that's a big problem.
You know, Palestinian observers, most associated with the political authorities in the West Bank, were telling us last week that the U.S. and Israel has completely ignored attempts by the Palestinian Authority based in the West Bank to unite with Hamas and to create a sort of middle ground centrist governmental authority, it sounds to me like what you're suggesting is that Hamas feels even maybe a little isolated from the Palestinian leaders on the West Bank and wants to go it alone for now.
I think that's true. And I think that the Palestinian Authority representatives at the UN and in Ramallah have been condemning the rockets from Gaza. The original idea, of course, on the Palestinian Authority side of having a unity deal with Hamas was that Hamas would eventually be under them, and Israel and the United States, Israel more, was worried that the opposite would occur. And so that's right. I think that right now the unity deal is gone, which I think was a goal of Israel. It was very unhappy with that. But I think the other thing not to forget is the broader context of what's going on in the region. And as Israel looks around and thinks to itself, you know, Hamas is only one direction to go as it looks to Syria and ISIS and so forth. And it's decided, I think, to have a more aggressive posture.
What about the people of Gaza when they look around? Do they look at ISIS and say, let's join the party? Or do they look at ISIS and they say, oh, my goodness, we have to prevent that at all costs? It's hard to know.
It is hard to know. My instinct from having spent a fair amount of time there in the past is that most people in Gaza are simply politically exhausted and have no notion of a political future. They just know that they would like to have some kind of economic and normal future. And so I would say most people in Gaza say, you know, a pox on both your houses, to both Fatah and Hamas. And, you know, then there is, of course, the other half, which is probably divided more toward Hamas than toward Fatah, and therefore possibly a little toward ISIS and Islamism. But I don't think it's a very large group. But, of course, it's a vocal group, and its guys are in power.
We're talking with Ethan Bronner, former bureau chief for Jerusalem. He's now deputy national editor for our partner, The New York Times. Ethan, you point out another odd irony here. I mean, when the Middle East, the Arab-Israeli conflict was at the center of regional politics and regional events, the dynamic has always been to get close to something and then everything explodes. Here you've got a situation where really both parties are more on the fringe. Everyone in the international community sees Syria as completely intransigent, looking at Iraq as just almost a basket case. Nobody knows how to correct that situation. Is it possible that this might be an opportunity for some interlocutor to actually weigh in and become a new sort of mediator here, and that there could be some momentum for a settlement? I'm, you know, speculating wildly, but that's all you can do.
Well, I think that was the notion behind John Kerry's endeavor with Martin Indyk between Israel and the Palestinians over the past 9 months. It collapsed, I guess, because the internal dynamic was so poisonous that this larger thought, which I think did animate both the Israeli leaders and the Palestinian leaders, was simply insufficiently persuasive, so that the internal dynamic, both politically and also their mutual disdain, meant that the larger picture became hard for them to go after. I mean, I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu, when you speak to him, and I've spoken to him often, and when you say to him, but this risk you are running of occupation and so forth is great, fundamentally his answer is, but the risk of getting out is greater.
Ethan Bronner, deputy national editor for our partner, The New York Times, former Jerusalem bureau chief for The Times. Thanks so much, Ethan.
Thank you, John. Good to talk to you.
When Americans are attacked, no matter how long it takes, we will find those responsible and we will bring them to justice.
That's President Obama speaking last month, talking about the apprehension of the suspect in the September 11th, 2012 Benghazi, Libya bombing. But what you may not know is that he might have actually planned on that very day to be talking about the financial crisis and bringing Wall Street to justice. The Department of Justice announces today a $7 billion settlement with Citigroup over the mishandling of mortgage securities that helped to set off the financial crisis. It's a big victory for the DOJ. They hope to show the American public they are getting tough on Wall Street. But our partner, The New York Times, says the timing of this announcement says everything about playing to the media rather than making motions to federal judges. Here with us is Ben Protest, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Ben, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What's the story here of the timing and how interesting this might have been delayed here?
Well, they originally were going to do the press conference on Citigroup that day, June 18th, and then the Benghazi arrest happened and they called it off and called the bank and said, we're going to delay this. We've got too many things going on right now. It turned out it was they didn't want the arrest to overshadow the Citigroup news.
Now, you know, that's a reasonable, expectation of the Justice Department. They want to get as much bang for their buck. They really want Citibank to hurt. Citibank might have wanted this to be buried in other news, right?
That's right. I think they were disappointed in some way. But on the other hand, it also opened the door to settlement talks, which led to the settlement today. So it really kind of was this twist of fate that nobody necessarily expected, but ultimately kind of had this this great opportunity for both sides to get back on the same page.
Do you think this is a cause and effect relationship, that it was going to be a full-scale prosecution announcement and then the Benghazi story happened and it became this $7 billion settlement?
That's right. They actually flew out the U.S. attorney from Colorado, John Walsh, to Washington to participate in the press conference. The press conference room was booked. They were telling journalists, be ready. Everybody expected the lawsuit to come down that Wednesday. And then suddenly the brakes were hit. And the only reason that ended up being was because of the PR maneuver and a smart one by the Justice Department.
As you and your colleagues tell it, the story, the Citibank was originally offering something like $100 million, then it got to a billion maybe, and the Justice Department was holding firm on $12 billion. This $7 billion does really represent pulling Citibank along here.
It's huge. So the bank initially offered $363 million.
Wow.
So right, there's a pretty huge gap there between $363 million and $12 billion. Certainly, I think anyone can do the math and figure out that ultimately the bank came more towards the government than the government coming towards the bank. But this took months of contentious negotiations, and really there was this fundamental disconnect where the bank wanted to calculate the penalty one way and the government had another more aggressive way of calculating. The bank wanted to do it based on its share of the mortgage security market, and the government said, look, it depends on the emails, it depends on the evidence. We can't do it just on your share of the mortgage market.
All right, we got a minute and 30 here. Can you explain this detail here that they wanted to account for it one way and the government wanted them to account it for another way? Because taxpayer money is, a lot of it is in the balance here.
That's right. So basically the government said to the bank, look, we're not going to rely on your assertions that just because you had a small portion of the mortgage security market back in 06, 07, 08, that doesn't mean that you get a free pass and you get to pay a small sum, perhaps less than $1 billion. The government said, we have great emails, we have great evidence, we have really just this body of investigation that really documents how the bank manipulated and had fraudulent mortgage practices where basically they duped investors into purchasing mortgage securities that ended up tanking when the market soured. So the idea the government said is you can't just rely on your share of the market. We have the evidence to prove that you owe billions and billions.
Do you believe this is punitive?
So I think that there is an argument that this is perhaps unfair and the numbers are arbitrary. The government has been pretty savvy. They're using a little known statute that allows them to use $1.1 million per violation. It's a statute called FIREA. It's really been a huge potent tool for them. So you get what you pay for.
$7 billion worth. Ben Protest, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Seasonal story now. As summer takes hold, it's happy time for ticks. It's an environmental paradise this time of year, along with the parasites that live inside ticks. It's also prime time for people who fear Lyme disease, which is a serious medical issue, but also an intangible fear for city dwellers who may find themselves in the forest hiking around. A multi-million dollar market of Lyme disease tests meant to reassure the fearful and also possibly enrich the opportunistic, many of which are not approved by the FDA, this market has proliferated in this environment. It's as much tick season as it is Lyme disease anxiety and testing season. Rupa Shenoy is a reporter with WGBH News and looked into this unregulated market for the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. Andrew Onderdonk is a professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School who's had the disease. We discuss the challenge of sorting real anxiety from real prevention.
When a test is approved by the FDA, it means that we know the testing characteristics. We know how sensitive it is, in other words, how well it detects whatever disease is supposed to be detecting. We know its limitations. And most importantly, we also know that the test that's being used is clinically relevant. That is, that if a test is positive, it does mean that one has the disease. The problem with non-approved tests is that we don't know what the characteristics of the tests are if it's only being done in a single laboratory. And we also don't know for sure whether or not the test that is being performed and patients are paying for actually is clinically relevant. In other words, does it really tell you if it's positive that you, in fact, have Lyme disease, or can it be something else?
Roopa Shenoy, what's the worst-case scenario of false positives on one of these FDA-unapproved tests, or even a false negative on an FDA-approved test?
We actually talked to a woman who kind of went through that scenario. She's a young mother. Her name is Brandy Dean, and she was watching her husband play soccer in a wooded area when she thinks she was bit by a tick, and she had some of these very severe symptoms.
I had heart palpitations, severe panic attacks, dizziness, I was losing my hearing, numbness along the right side of my body, and vertigo.
And she went to doctors and had FDA-approved tests. And some of them came back positive and some of them came back negative. But the doctors early on declined to treat her for Lyme because she didn't have the characteristic bullseye symptom, the rash. She had a rash, but not that specific rash. And Brandy Dean says, you know, no one trusts tests anymore, and that's part of the problem.
I don't think any of us have any confidence in the tests that are available to us now, which is very unfortunate because I think once you are able to diagnose the illness, then, you know, you can help treat these people who are very sick.
Is part of the problem here, Roopa Shenoy, that the ambiguity of the disease's onset and some of the symptoms, particularly later on, produces a level of need to know more or yearning for some sort of definitive test among consumers?
Absolutely. People, the symptoms can be very severe, and without definitive answers, I mean, it spurs emotions of desperation.
Should the FDA widen this to deal with problems that Brandy had of feeling like everyone's ignoring her symptoms, which she feels is absolutely real, Andrew Onderdonk?
The FDA does not tell anybody how to diagnose a disease. And in fact, at least in the Northeast, where the majority of cases of Lyme disease occurs, the recommendation is to treat symptomatically. In other words, if a patient thinks they have a tick bite and they have any of the characteristic symptoms of Lyme disease, then in this part of the country, they normally would get treated. Now, there are cases like my own where I never had a rash. I never got any of the early symptoms. When I got sick, it was basically the organism was infecting my nerves, and it was excruciatingly painful. Fortunately, because I'm a microbiologist, I suspected Lyme disease and went and had the tests, which were positive, and I was able to get the appropriate treatment. But some people, if they don't suspect a tick bite or they don't develop the characteristic symptoms, may have Lyme disease for quite some time and just goes undiagnosed. And I think that's a problem.
Andrew Onderdonk is a professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School. He was formerly diagnosed with Lyme disease. He's also the director of the Clinical Microbiology Lab at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. We also spoke with Roopa Shenoy, reporter with our partner WGBH and the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. Last word on World Cup. World Cup, 1-0. Germans over Argies. Europe, we're still here. South America, hope didn't help much. Argentina, heartbreak. Brazil, choke. Deutschland, über alles. FIFA, unimaginable corruption. Buenos Aires, in mourning. Berlin, partying. Rio, unspeakable poverty, but nice sunsets. Does that sum it up pretty well? What do you think? Here to discuss the 2014 World Cup and its legacy going forward is George Vesey, contributing sports columnist at the New York Times, author of the recent book, 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. George, welcome back.
Nice to be here again.
So what did you think? What was your impression? That was a very exciting goal there at the end.
Well, I hate to say this, but having picked Germany back in February for a magazine article I wrote, having picked Brazil and Argentina to finish third and fourth, I had the feeling that I had the usual suspects, mostly in the final four, as we say. So, yeah, I could see Germany was coming on since 2006. They had this wonderful tournament in their home country. They were coming on. They finished third the last two World Cups. And I just felt like if any nation could go into the home, the emotional home of football, which is Brazil, and take it all, it was Germany.
And they really cleaned up the mess taking control of Messi from Argentina. He wasn't really even a factor.
He wasn't a factor. There's a great picture in the New York Times this morning of him surrounded by four defenders, which is what you do. Of course, people did that with Maradona back in the day. I remember Maradona was surrounded by at least four or five defenders by Brazil in 1990, and he still unleashed a sensational pass to Claudio Caniggia. That's the difference between Maradona and Messi. And I think all of us, the whole world is unfair to Messi to compare him to Maradona, because I think there's only one Maradona in any – not in any generation, but in any cycle for a nation, a soccer nation, and it's just unfair. Messi's not the player Maradona was.
No, one's a machine and one is magic. Right. And really what that game lacked was that sort of magic. But the goal from – he was a substitution, I believe, the German, right, there at the end?
Goetze, I believe it's pronounced. Yeah, he came in. I think he was the last guy in next to last guy in as a substitute. And, of course – with Germany, you're talking about a player from Bayern Munich who is well-known, is in their pipeline. They are so deep. I mean, I pointed out, again, in this magazine article that I wrote months ago, the U.S., in hoping to get out of its group, would wind up against Germany in the third match. And the hope was they would get Germany's second stringers in that third match. And then I pointed out, yeah, Germany's second stringers, that's the guy that won the World Cup.
Now, did you know back when you wrote this magazine article where you predicted everything absolutely correctly?
Well, no, I had Spain in the final.
Oh, I see. Well, almost correctly.
On myself, I had Spain in the final.
Did you know that the winning goal would be struck by someone who has a supermodel girlfriend? Did you know that as well?
Well, don't they all? I mean, I was sitting in front of the TV yesterday, and I saw one of the players who didn't get used yesterday, Julian Draxler, and he goes over to the stands, and he brings out – he bargains with the security guard. Out comes this gorgeous young woman, and I'm thinking either that's his girlfriend or fiancé, or else he just needed a date for the party. You know, it's nice to be a footballer.
Boy, don't we sound like a couple of old fogies.
Well,
yeah, that's for sure.
What can I say? My wife allowed me to say that.
Let's talk a little bit about what this meant for Brazil, the expenditure, the fact that the U.S. paid a lot of attention. It was on ABC News and it was ABC Sports. It was ESPN broadcast the whole tournament. Right. It was a very big deal in the United States.
It was a big deal. And the media, I mean, the New York Times, from what I understand, sent 17 people there, you know, techies and photographers you might not notice. So it's become a big deal. I think the United States is acknowledging, I mean, the fact that there was such a bidding war for the next couple of World Cups, which ESPN is not getting. It's going over to Fox. But it is a huge deal. And I think this World Cup proved, not just because the United States had a decent run, but just because of the pubs, the cable, it being everywhere, it proved that the United States is at least up for this quadrennial party. We recognize that there's an equivalent to the Super Bowl, and it comes around every 4 years.
All right. So here's the billion-dollar question. Did the World Cup in the United States, excluding Cleveland, was that a bigger story than LeBron this weekend in the U.S.?
I would say not necessarily this weekend, not necessarily the final, although certainly the final was a great match and people watched it. But when you get a celebrity like that, I mean, that's one of our major sports. I could certainly concede that LeBron is a main story. However, the broad sense is what's more to celebrate, to go out and have a good time in somebody's living room? I mean, LeBron, it's an interesting story. He's going back, and I applaud him for going back to his home. Nice that he could see his way through to that. But still, the World Cup was a party, and I suspect a lot of people were watching. I haven't seen the numbers.
For all of you who are living under a rock, we should just update you. Germany won the World Cup 1-0 over Argentina, and LeBron James is leaving the Miami Heat and going back to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA. That happened this weekend, just for those of you who weren't really paying attention. A lot of huge monster-like celebrity important dignitaries at the World Cup in the in Brazil.
Oh, absolutely. It's a big deal. I understand that James and I think one of his buddies, Dwayne Wade, was it?
Putin was there. Merkel.
Well, she would be there because she was standing next to Dilma, the president of Brazil, which was a nice sight to see two women heading major countries. And
Putin had an entourage.
And I'm sure that there were all kinds of people in the stands just because they could afford to go there. That's what it's become. It's become the world, I mean, and has been for a while, but as people spend the money. Now, the question is where does the World Cup go from here? What are the implications to Germany winning this? It's the third straight time that a European nation has won the World Cup. All these European nations, major football nations, having players at their command, stay-at-home stars who stay there. I think ultimately out of this, and perhaps that Dilma and Angela might have had this conversation between two heads of state about a North-South or Latin America-Europe kind of economic question.
That's great.
Is all the power tilting toward the Champions League level of football?
Two thoughts on the U.S. team, and then we got to go.
Sure. Two thoughts. The U.S. is going in the right direction with Klinsmann, who not only was a great player and is a smart guy, but he comes from the German system that produced these three teams. He was part of that. He was in on it. It is a system. They have had a program.
We just need a couple of South Americans. That's all.
That's the next thing going on is to find as many as you can. And believe me, they're trying.
George Vesey, contributing sports columnist to the New York Times and author of the recent book, 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the World Cup. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. George, thanks so much.
Always nice to be here.
You know, at the end of the hour here, in a way, one of the most famous English novels of the 20th century is all about this World Cup ambivalence, about the steamy, raw world of Latin culture and the proper, ambitious sterility of the much more prosperous world of Northern Europe. Spain versus Britain, Germany versus Argentina, and how the United States, culturally, is caught in the middle of it all. This is a novel about a lady. That's how the very ambivalent Ernest Hemingway first began The Sun Also Rises. Those lines and the entire first chapter of the book were eventually just tossed away. This week, Hemingway readers get a new experience with this old classic. Scribner is releasing a version of the book that's never been seen before. It includes lost chapters, extensive revisions, giving an altogether new portrait of Hemingway's creative process regarding this coming-of-age story of young men caught between life and living. Sean Hemingway is the grandson of Ernest Hemingway and editor of this new edition of The Sun Also Rises.
This new Hemingway Library edition of The Sun Also Rises really gets into that and how my grandfather wrote the book. And it was, I think he'd written many short stories and he'd tried to write a novel before, but and it was lost at the train station in Paris.
Crazy story.
At the Gare de Lyon, must have been terribly frustrating for him. But after going to Pamplona, he really knew he had a great subject and he went at it furiously. He knew he had to write a novel. He'd been writing so many wonderful short stories, but he needed a novel.
And, you know, in our time, it would never happen that you'd lose a whole novel, you know, because it would be on some hard drive somewhere. In many ways, that might have been the best thing that ever happened to him, having to recreate those scenes and really confront that language again to have something completely lost so that he wasn't just re-editing some version.
I think that's a really good point. We'll never really know exactly what that first novel was, but I don't think it was the masterpiece that The Sun Also Rises is. And I think he learned a tremendous amount in Paris, you know, mingling with all these other great writers and artists and luminaries. It was a great training ground for him.
Do you think he fell in love with that time and was aware of it in the way that we are so aware of it when we read this book?
It's funny because I think in some of the deleted passages that are included in this new edition, he disparages a bit the quarter and his colleagues, and yet he clearly sat at the foot of Gertrude Stein and learned from her and was greatly influenced by her. I think he was very caught up in it. I mean, he was living it. Later on in his life and works like A Movable Feast, he really goes back and reflects differently on it.
What do you hope that the reader gets from this particular edition that would be different from someone coming from The Sun Also Rises the very first time?
Well, this edition allows you to really pull back the curtain and look at the creative writing process that my grandfather went through. And it's amazing to think that this was his first novel to be published and how the problems he had writing it and how he went about writing it. And he really He threw himself into it. He wrote the first draft in 2 months. And later he said that he wrote too quickly and he had to do a lot of editing. So you can see that. You can see examples of the first draft and how different it is from the final product and all the changes that he did to finish the book and polish it and make it the way he wanted it to be.
You know, in many ways you describe the collaboration and the friendship between Ernest Hemingway, other writers of the time, Hudson, Ford Madox Ford. Where do you think your grandfather stands in comparison with those two writers who are also struggling with some of the same issues of what's going on in the 20th century?
I think my grandfather is right up there. I mean, he chose as subjects in his books to deal a lot with the consequences of war, both World War I and World War II and the Spanish Civil War. War was a subject for him that was a powerful subject that he wrote about a lot. Of course, he was also a naturalist like Hudson, and he loved to write about hunting and fishing and experiencing nature. I think my grandfather is right up there with those writers, and that's part of the amazing thing about this book, I think, that it has appealed to generation after generation of people, especially young people reading it. It has a vitality and a fresh quality that it still resonates today. I think what's fascinating in the material that's included in this new edition is this unpublished foreword that he wrote for it and how serious it is, how literary and how, I mean, he's sort of depressed really about the effects of World War I and how for his generation that has devastated everyone and that they can't move beyond it. And that's what you see in this book, in The Sun Also Rises, is these broken people who can't move beyond the damages of the war. And some of the background of that is included in these discarded chapters from the beginning of the novel that Hemingway cut at the galley stage. But it's all still there. It's under the surface, as my grandfather used to like to say about his writing.
Do you think that foreword and this book speaks in many ways to the people 100 years after World War I who are wondering about this moment in time right now, that he's really speaking
today? I think it does, unfortunately, because around the world we continue to be involved in conflicts, not just America, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we see the wars in Syria and the conflicts going on in Palestine. I mean, the war is everywhere, and I think this book remains a very powerful reference point for seeing how damaged people are by war, whether it's physically damaged like Jake Barnes, or whether it's someone like Bill Campbell or Brett Ashley who have been emotionally damaged. And there are thousands of people around the world who come back with post-traumatic stress disorder from war for serving their countries and have to go on and live their lives, and they do the best they can. But it is it's a phenomenon that continues.
Do you think the way this book was received and some of that part of the experience you get into in this edition constituted the happiest moments of your grandfather's life?
Well, I think he was delighted at the reception of it, and it was a success from the moment it was published. It was important to him, but in other ways, I think that he wasn't proud of the way the people act in the book. Mm. I mean, his mother wouldn't read the book because she felt it was too immoral.
Crazy, yeah, yeah.
Acts in it. But one of the interesting things, I think, in this new edition is it includes the original beginning of the book, which focuses on the bullfighter. And the story was originally going to be more about the bullfighter and the dissolution of a bullfighter, but that totally changed as he wrote the book. And in the end, the bullfighter becomes the character who is closest, truest to himself and his art.
What do you think he would say about this project and you? Would he say, get out of my desk? What are you doing messing around with all this?
That's a good question. You know, I never knew my grandfather. Right. He died before I was born, so I can only imagine what he would say. And I think it is true that he saved all of his manuscripts. I think he recognized that he was a great writer and that he would have a place in world literature. And by saving all of these manuscripts, he knew that they would be studied and examined and published eventually. So I hope that I think he would appreciate the care with which I've looked at these manuscripts and also the care with which I've tried to preserve his legacy, his huge legacy to America and the world.
Well, Sean Hemingway, are you a good fisherman?
I love to fish, yes, thank you.
All right, so he'd be proud of that, certainly. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sean Hemingway is a curator in the Department of Greek and Roman Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. He's the editor of the new Scribner's The Sun Also Rises, and he's also the grandson of Ernest Hemingway, the editor of this new edition. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Pedro the Bull was a killer, king of the bullfighter arena. He'd wipe up the floor with each brave matador, then have matador stew for his dinner. He heard the crowd shouting, ole, ole! He met his master that day.